When the organization that protects us from disease loses funding, it's not good.
It was really a terrible time. And in my nearly 8 years as CDC director, it was the only time I felt like I couldn't do my job of protecting Americans.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The film industry needs a new set of rules to end sexual harassment.
What works in a corporate world for sexual harassment, where you have an HR office and you can have certain sit-down training, doesn't work on a film set where the production is moving very fast-paced.
And why do we enjoy watching bad, bad, terrible movies?
So what if we do develop this selenite bomb? We'd be even a stronger nation than now. Strong. You see? You see? Your stupid minds! Stupid! Stupid!
All that and more coming up, but first the news. From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Hollywood is trying to end sexual harassment on its movie sets, but it's not easy.
What if the person that commits harassment is an actor that cannot be replaced? What if it happens and it's he said, she said type of scenario? How do you investigate it without slowing down your production?
We'll learn about an initiative to get ahead of sexual misconduct on Georgia's film sets this hour. But yesterday, we spent our whole show exploring the debate over Confederate monuments. I spoke with Elizabeth Herbin-Triant. She's a professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell and believes those monuments send a clear message.
They have a political bent, for sure, and I would want to respond to the historical argument by saying, let's put them in a museum, right? If they're a historical artifact, a museum is probably the best spot for them, right? We don't have other historical artifacts sort of in public squares in front of courthouses.
We heard from many of you after that show, and here are just a few of your first thoughts.
Hey, my name is Jeremy Hagler, and I've been listening to your last hour here talking about the Confederate monument. And it really seems like it's a one-sided argument that you guys are trying to give. And in reality, these monuments are memorials to men who stood up and defended their home. And, you know, we can talk about slavery all we want, but at the end of the day, the large majority of people in the South did not own slaves.
Cindy Aiken from Georgia. I think you should make a museum. Put them all in one area. Being that they're scattered around, to be honest, I never even looked at them. But in a museum, we could learn so much about history. It is history. And I'm a foreigner, many foreigners that could learn about the history of that era. So please don't throw them away. Put them in a museum.
We love getting your thoughts. Where do you think Confederate monuments belong? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on social media. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. A week ago today, Brenda Fitzgerald resigned as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. It turns out she has financial stakes in a tobacco company, and that's a major conflict of interest. The CDC also faces enormous budget cuts. The agency is preparing to downsize its global epidemic prevention programs by about 80%. We are currently in the middle of a record-breaking flu epidemic, so should we be worried about the CDC's ability to do its job? Joining me to discuss this is Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC. He's now president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, a global health initiative. Welcome back, doctor.
Great to be on with you.
So let's address this issue of Brenda Fitzgerald and conflicts of interest. Do you think it was right for her to step down?
It became clear that given her financial situation, there was just too much complexity for her to continue. And so that she decided to step down, and that seems like that was the right decision. I do think it's very important that all of us in public health avoid not just impropriety, but the appearance of impropriety. And when you enter the public sphere, there are just certain things you can't do in terms of financial commitments.
You wrote an op-ed on not only that issue, but other things facing the CDC right now, and it appears that you think that the director of the CDC needs to be something other than just a political appointee. Should it be a scientist?
It's really important that the director of the CDC have three core characteristics. First, they have to be science-based. CDC is our nation's public health agency. They are the people who can speak truth to power. And whether one side or the other side doesn't like it, the data that comes out has to be defended and has to be rigorous and technically correct. Second, someone who runs the CDC should have a history of successfully running public health programs. CDC has to get things done. One of the things that's a huge challenge now is the opiate epidemic. This is continuing to increase, and the likelihood is that 2017 will show for the third year running an increase in deaths and a decrease in life expectancy. That's the first time that will have happened in a century. So successful program management experience is very important. Finally, the head of the CDC has to be able to advocate for CDC. CDC is in Atlanta, in Georgia, and that's different from being in the Beltway in Washington, and there's too much risk that CDC is out of sight and out of mind when it comes to providing resources, funding. CDC needs resources. It needs a budget. So it's very important that people throughout Georgia, throughout Atlanta, and throughout the country protect CDC so that CDC can protect all our health.
So I wonder what you think then about this massive cutback in programs and the fact that the CDC is expecting to stop many of its programs that are out in the field in other countries. Is that going to affect the agency's ability to protect people here domestically?
I hope that the big rollback of the global health security program to reduce the risk of epidemics won't happen. The risk here is that CDC faces what's called a fiscal cliff. Next year, the money that was appropriated for CDC to help other countries stop epidemics there so we don't have to fight them here, that money will disappear. And if those programs disappear, we will be less safe. I'm hopeful because there are many individuals within the administration, within both the House and the Senate, in both political parties, who recognize that these programs are a best buy and are critically important to protecting Americans. I hope that when the budget is actually enacted for 18 and for 19, these programs will be saved so that Americans can be protected.
But when you hear, when I've heard politicians speaking about funding for the CDC, especially this funding that goes overseas, it sounds like they put it in the same bucket as foreign aid. Why is that not correct?
We live in a globally interconnected world. Within 2 days, a virus that's spreading anywhere in the world could be in the U.S. There's no way that we can protect Americans from health threats just by working within our own borders. The only way to keep Americans as safe as possible is to identify and help stop threats where they first emerge so that we don't have to fight them on our shores.
How concerned are you that the CDC will fall off that cliff? What kind of conversations have you had about it?
I'm very worried, because if that were to happen, we would be less safe. I'm encouraged by the fact that people within the administration, within Congress, in both House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats, all see the value of these programs. But it's an important step between seeing the value of a program and funding it so that it can continue. And we'll only know over the next months and year or so whether that actually happens. And if it doesn't, that will mean pulling the rug out from programs that have taken years to develop. Relationships with other countries, training of doctors and nurses and disease detectives in other countries so that they can do the work stopping disease and we don't have to. All of that work is critically endangered if this funding doesn't continue.
Dr. Tom Frieden is the former director of the CDC, now president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, a global health initiative. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To continue this conversation, we're joined by Andy Miller, who's CEO and editor of Georgia Health News. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Celeste.
A few things that Dr. Frieden mentioned. Let's begin with the opiate crisis. When many people think about the CDC, they're thinking about viruses, right? Ebola and getting your flu vaccine. What involvement does the CDC have in handling the opiate crisis?
Well, one is education, and certainly they putting the word out about how dangerous these drugs are. Another is in prevention and in trying to get the right response in terms of the medical community to this crisis. And it is spiraling out of control, not just here in Georgia, but across the country.
Yeah, the death toll is getting bigger and bigger. And there's another thing that people sometimes forget, and that's the research component of the CDC, that oftentimes the CDC is able to get hard numbers on health crises that you can't get anywhere else.
Right. They just came out with a report yesterday about how asthma attacks among children are going down, which was terrific news. And it shows that their programs to help families create healthy houses for kids is working.
So let's talk then first about the director stepping down. And again, the Brenda Fitzgerald was the director of the CDC. She stepped down because she had financial ties with a tobacco company. How closely do they monitor financial ties like that, conflicts of interest for the leaders of the CDC?
Well, I think they have to disclose early on what their holdings were. And Dr. Fitzgerald had a conflict previous to this in the fact that she held stock in a cancer detection company and a health IT company, both of which she couldn't divest according to the requirements of that stock ownership. But that caused some issues in terms of her testifying on cancer and on opiates before Congress. So there was a little bit of unsettled feeling in Congress about that. And then when the Politico report came out that she bought, through a financial manager, she bought shares in Japan Tobacco, a couple of drug companies, as well as a health insurance company. That kind of tipped the balance over, and it was just a matter of time before she resigned.
And Dr. Frieden made a point of saying that the CDC is in Atlanta and not D.C. What point is he making there?
I think because you have so many interest groups and so many government agencies based in Washington, they're right there. They're basically can lobby Congress very easily and effectively and often do, but we're considered pretty far away, and
yeah, we're outside the Beltway.
That's right, and we have to get our Congress people involved as well as keep this discussion about this prevention money out there, because I feel we don't spend enough on prevention.
Well, that could be a new motto for the CDC, inside the Beltline, but outside the Beltway. Is anyone at the CDC offices listening now? I feel like that's pretty good. Okay, so then let's go to this, finally, to this issue of funding. How concerned are you? Dr. Frieden seems to be very concerned. Is there a chance that, in fact, the CDC will end 80% of its overseas programs?
I think there's a good chance, and it would be a very bad move, because these countries are where epidemics start. And this money goes to laboratories, to diagnostics, to testing, to improving public health response in these countries so that these emerging epidemics don't cross their borders and eventually come into America. And, I'm also concerned about the overall CDC budget. When we finally do get a federal spending plan and Congress gets their act together on that, what's the overall budget for CDC going to look like?
You're saying we only have about a minute left, but you're saying that because there's a chance they may be looking to cut the overall budget?
It's a matter of where the administration's priorities are. And I think now there's a lot of uncertainty within the agency. They don't have a director. They don't have a budget plan to go on. One good thing is they've got a good acting director, Ann Schuchat, who people really respect.
Okay, Andy Miller is CEO and editor of Georgia Health News. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Up next, why do we love to hate watch? First, though, the Me Too movement is taking the film industry by storm, and Georgia's movie community is responding. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Over the past year, Hollywood has been rocked by scandal after scandal. Some of the most powerful figures in the industry have been accused of sexual misconduct.
Harvey Weinstein has just resigned from the board of directors of the Weinstein Company, but it wasn't just a resignation. This was either you resign or we're firing you.
The growing backlash for Kevin Spacey amid that sexual misconduct accusation. Netflix announcing the end of House of Cards.
Comedian Louis C.K. is the latest entertainer accused of inappropriate sexual behavior.
A group of women in Georgia's film community want to address sexual abuse in our state. They founded a group called Safety Shot. And I'm joined now by two of them. Susan Satterfield is a longtime filmmaker who works on TV pilots, documentaries, and indie films as well. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
And also with us is attorney Laura Lundy, attorney and actress, I should say. Laura Lundy, it's good to have you as well.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with Laura. It appears that the first thing that needs to happen is a definition of terms, right? We don't in Georgia have a clear definition of what is sexual harassment.
Right. So, and when we're talking specifically more in, like, I guess the civil realm, I divide the law between civil and criminal. We'd have a criminal, and that would be sexual assault, aggravated sexual assault. But for the civil realm, it's really under Title VII, which is federal law, not state law, that they have a definition. So in order to bring a claim, for example, in Georgia, you would have to maybe bring it under intentional infliction of emotional distress or some other claim.
I want to play this comment from Gabrielle Pickle, an Atlanta-based film producer that has worked with both of you to start up Safety Shot. She actually was in a scary situation a few years ago. She felt threatened by a colleague on a film project, and she says that person was fired, but it actually made her worry more.
I was able to handle it because I am a producer and I do have influence with the people above me to address that, but it just terrified me because if it happened to me as a woman who is in charge, how much more is it happening to every person who is not in power? And that's what just terrified me, that I didn't know how to protect my PAs.
Production assistants. So Susan, this has been a relatively common theme that we hear about these very powerful, famous women who've been subject to pretty horrible things. How does one protect a production assistant, a walk-on? You know what I mean? How do you protect the people who have zero power on a set?
I think there's several things we can do. I mean, as producers, the people in charge need to take responsibility and make sure that everybody understands what the culture of the production is. We're kind of a pop-up business, so
well, you mean the whole film industry?
The whole film industry. Well, you know, even television shows that are ongoing. You know, you don't have in a lot of cases a human resources person on set. Certainly in indie films, that's not the case. So you need to, the producer, the people in charge need to make sure the whole crew understands what the boundaries are and what's allowed. And then people who are not as empowered need to know who can they go to? How do you report if something does happen? You know, and how do you make sure that people are not retaliated against?
And this is kind of a question. Let me play another comment from your colleague, Gabrielle Pickle, who says making sexual harassment awareness is one of the priorities that needs to happen pretty much immediately.
I've had people come to me, hey, I don't know if this is harassment, but I saw this, let's talk about this, and just being very upfront. And we're like, no, that's not really harassment, but maybe we should let's just say something just in case so that people know this person felt uncomfortable. And just kind of empowering people to watch out for each other and speak up. It's been really pretty incredible.
So Laura, there has been conversation about whether or not the Me Too movement is going too far. Right. And it sounds a bit like Gabrielle's addressing that people are aware of what is an inappropriate behavior and what is not. How do you sort of draw those lines?
Well, I think one is doing kind of what Gabby is doing, what she's done is she's inserted a protocol so that people know, okay, if I see something, I can come forward and report it. I think also it is, you know, the unions in our field of work coming out with videotapes or something that gives hypotheticals in defining a situation, and people can look to that and say, okay, this kind of fits my scenario, so I maybe need to go forward and report this.
But one of the things, Susan, is that, as you were mentioning, we're not talking about an office building. We're not talking about a whole lot of privacy in many cases. You're often on a set going to complain to the very people who hired that actor or that person on the crew. How do you make that easier for a woman or in some cases a man to report?
Well, we're all having a come to Jesus right now, honestly. And all the guilds, all the unions are looking at what they have in place and finding that in some cases it's not enough, mm-hmm. that we really need to have more clarity. We need to have more boundaries. We need to I'm a member of the Producers Guild, and they're working on a draft right now, an anti-sexual harassment draft that has all the components of, you know, training, your paperwork, reporting, how you make sure people feel safe, you know, who having a designated person or two on set that everybody knows they can come to, but if for some reason you can't go to that person, there's a backup person. They're talking about also anonymous reporting where you can call a hotline or you can even use an app to report a situation so that that information goes into a vault and it's there right after it happened so that that person who may have been a victim of sexual harassment has a minute to think about how am I going to screw up their courage, if you will, and decide, because not everybody wants to report. It's a scary thing.
Now, you went through an incident in your own career several years ago or quite some time ago?
Yes, it was when I was just starting out, and it was my first feature film, and I was hired as the director's assistant. I was thrilled to have that position, and the director came in from L.A., and the first week or so was fine. Our relationship was completely professional, and then at one point I was asked to come to the hotel suite to help him make script changes. And my mother said, why would anybody go to the hotel rooms? But it's very common that we're working out of hotels, right? So, I had a Harvey Weinstein type incident with that person. And fortunately,
he was naked.
He was exposing himself, let's say. So, and literally chasing me around the hotel room.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so it was terrifying.
The reason I ask about that is because did you end up reporting that?
No, I did not. I knew that the only person above him was a good friend of his, and I knew that if I reported it, I would be gone. And, you know, that was the last time he tried to do anything like that because I was, you know, I clearly
running screaming
I was
around
running
a room.
Screaming away. I was clearly not going to cooperate. But you know, I saw him harass several other people over the course. I warned the women that I could, which is a common thing. We warn each other under the radar.
See, and this is the problem, Laura, because the way that we have functioned in the past, and I, in full disclosure, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA myself, and have been, in some cases, part of some of the reporting on this. This is the problem, is that women, we tell each other privately. How do we make it possible for somebody like Susan, who's just getting her first big break, to safely report this? Is the union the way to do that? Because indie films are often non-union.
Yeah, and you know, we've been having this conversation about how do you give a person the courage to come forward. And I think that you do that by having someone in a place where they feel they in such a level of power or equal level of power, be that a woman or a man that is that has a reputation of not allowing this to happen. And so there's almost like this buddy system, right? That like I know I can come forward because I have someone in the level of power, kind of like what Susan was saying, that there was nobody above him that she felt comfortable that would be on her side. And I think that if that means
she would have been fired.
Right. And yeah. And I think you have to give the person courage to come forward without fear of retaliation or something like that. And if that means having people in the level of power, then that needs what needs to be.
All right. So we're going to move on to talk about some of the things that Safety Shot has come up with. But first, let's hear from Gabby one more time, Gabrielle Pickle. Currently working on a film that's being shot here in Atlanta. It's starring Leslie Odom Jr. and Frida Pinto. And this is the first Georgia-based production, according to Gabby, that follows the protocols that have been developed by your group to address sexual misconduct. And she says, in everybody's contract that they signed, there is a clause about sexual harassment.
We are a zero-tolerance set, and that they are specifically signing up to saying they've read it, and that they know that they can be dismissed if this is proven, and that we will get the unions involved. The unions have different hotline numbers that they have provided for people to call, and it's both for people who have been harassed as well as people who are being harassed by a member of that union or guild.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with filmmaker Susan Satterfield and actress slash attorney Laura Lundy. They've helped start this initiative called Safety Shot that hopes to address sexual harassment and assault within Georgia's film industry. So what is in the clause that people are signing when they sign the contract? She says there's a zero tolerance, but is there also, Laura, a description of what sexual harassment is?
So for her, it outlines a protocol of reporting, which before now, and what Gabby was saying is that that was not included in the contract.
Yeah.
And so what she's done is she's set forth a protocol of, if you feel like you are having sexual advances made towards you, and if you don't adhere to those advances, that there's going to be some sort of retaliation, or if you feel like you all of a sudden have an unsafe work environment, that you don't feel comfortable coming to work, you're unable to perform your job, then you need to come forward and report that circumstance.
Do you think, Susan, that we have, I guess, crossed the Rubicon here? Or I know that there's many people who feel like, look, the Me Too movement is going to be over, it'll quiet down, and then things go back to business as usual. Do you think that's true?
I really don't think that's true. I think that people are feeling way more empowered. This has been something that has been, as we said, a whisper network. And I think really, truly, the time is up. I think there are a lot of women who feel like they've tried to color inside the lines, follow the rules, play by all the rules, play it safe, and not make waves. And things have only gotten worse instead of better. So I don't think it's going to go back to what it was. Is there some backlash and potential for backlash? I mean, that is the case. And this is on a, you know, this behavior is on a spectrum. And, you know, we do recognize, you know, there are people who unintentionally offend, and there are people who basically have predatory behavior at the other end of the spectrum.
Do you treat them differently?
I think so. I think, you know, someone who unintentionally offends deserves a warning.
Someone who asks out an employee, maybe, and didn't maybe realize.
Right, exactly. You know, and as long as they are not trying to retaliate or continue that behavior, you know, sometimes people are just not as sensitive as they need to be. And so, you know, I think we do owe people a warning if it's something mild and it doesn't seem intentional. But, you know, sexual harassment is really a kind of bullying in a lot of cases. I mean, if you take out the word sexual, it's just bullying behavior. It's a power dynamic.
So where do you look, Laura, for guidelines on how to make this better? Are there other states that are also moving forward this? Is Hollywood itself moving forward with this in terms of finding best practices?
I think so. Like Susan mentioned, the PGA is coming out with a draft on it.
Producers Guild of America.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, Producers Guild of America. And I know that SAG-AFTRA is as well. And it's caused everyone to look at their system and reevaluate and find the discrepancies in their system. And I know for these two unions, we're definitely seeing a change.
Do you think there is more sexual harassment and assault in Hollywood, or that those cases are just getting more attention?
I think that they're getting more attention. I know that for myself, you know, I'm also in the legal world, and it's also a power dynamic of, you know,
predominantly male.
Right. And so, and the only time I've experienced it personally was in the legal world. It was not in the film world, for example. And so I do think that it's getting more attention because it's the media I mean, it's not, and it's people who have the platform to speak. That's part of why it's getting so much attention drawn to it, is because you have people who are these public figures who have a platform to speak on, and they're stepping up to the plate and talking about it.
So, Susan, do you have any hopes that what happens with your effort and other efforts in Hollywood will then have effects in places like restaurants and, you know, secretarial pools?
I was really excited about the Time's Up movement when they came out. That was part of their message and part of their initiative to say, you know, we're not just speaking out for people in the film industry or women in Hollywood. We are concerned about women who don't have the voice. We recognize that there are a lot of women who don't have the power that we do, and we want to stand up for them as well.
Mm. And within the minute that we have left, do you agree that do you think that there's more sexual harassment in Hollywood, or there's just more attention on it?
I think that in the culture, it has been allowed to run rampant because of people like Harvey Weinstein, and because of the pop-up nature of things, and, you know, lack of an HR department. So I think perhaps it had to get this bad for something to change.
Interesting. That's filmmaker Susan Satterfield and actress slash attorney Laura Lundy. The two helped start an initiative called Safety Shot. It's meant to address sexual harassment and assault within Georgia's film industry. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, there are movies and TV shows that are so bad we can't turn them off. Why do we hate watch? This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Tomorrow we'll hear about plans to build a truck-only highway in Georgia. The Georgia DOT estimates the project would decrease traffic by 40% over the next decade or so. So, should trucks be separated from the rest of traffic? And do you think that's the best way to reduce congestion on our highways? Give us a call and leave a message. We are at 404-500-9457, and I know lots of you like to complain about traffic, so we want to hear from you. Be sure to join us tomorrow, of course, for that conversation at 9 a.m. You know, some things are so bad, they come full circle around to good. So imagine being marooned in a movie theater. You're forced to watch the worst movies of all time, for all time. And that is the premise behind the show Mystery Science Theater 3000. It features a human and his two robot sidekicks. They're on a spaceship. They're riffing on the movies they love to hate. Diehard show fans probably know this character from the series.
The evil Dr. Forrester was hatching a nasty scheme.
I rule the world, yes! I'm a naughty boy!
That is the mad scientist Clayton Forrester, introduced at the start of each episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He was played by Trace Beaulieu, who also wrote for the show and portrayed the character Crow T. Robot. Trace and one of his MST3K co-stars bring their movie riffing to Atlanta this weekend for a live audience, and he joins me on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how do you translate Mystery Science Theater into a live show?
It's very simple. Frank Conniff and I, two microphones and a bad movie and an audience. And that's we've stripped down the premise to its very core.
Which actually really sounds like how the show started. Let me play this comment from another creator, Joel Hodson, who we spoke with a few months ago about the start of the series, and he said it started with just a fan base and a tiny production budget airing on a UFH channel.
I didn't trust my ability to talk executives into anything, and I felt that I could talk an audience into something. So I started out by making Mystery Science Theater, which was the cheapest show I could think of because I thought it would be fueled with public domain movies, and all we would need is a green screen and a little set, and we'd be able to make it.
Is that kind of what the live show is like?
Yeah, we've dispensed with any kind of expense. And it's just the riffing and the movie. And I don't think we could get it any cheaper. I guess Frank or I could not show up, and that would eliminate some costs. But someone has to be there riffing on the movie. But, yeah, it's really just a simple idea. The audience is a huge part of it, and that's why Frank and I love doing these live shows. As opposed to being isolated in a theater, in a television station, as we were for years and years, that really was like being trapped in space.
Right. But how did you know people would want to watch bad movies?
I think we all really love these films. There's sort of a warm and comforting feeling. It's kind of like having a slightly bad electric heater in a cabin somewhere.
But that sounds scary.
Yeah, knowing that it's somewhat reliable and you do get some warmth off of it, but you can still complain a little bit.
All right, well, let's hear a clip from a 1991 episode of Mystery Science Theater. The movie being riffed on here is Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Let's see if we can locate Santa Claus. He wears a red suit,
mm-hmm.
trimmed with white fur, and he has a long white beard.
Wait a minute, you
but
just described
He-Bear. It's like looking for a speck of space dust in a comet's tail.
Oh, good analogy.
Wait a minute. I see him. I see Santa Claus.
And he's kissing Mommy.
So, Trace, did you kind of imagine that that's what everybody does when they're watching bad movies?
Yeah, you know, that's what we all did before we started doing Mystery Science Theater, was watching bad movies with our friends and family and commenting on them. I think everybody does it. I think that's part of the appeal to this form of comedy, that everyone can do it. It's just that we have microphones.
And you're a little funnier than my family, frankly.
Well, hopefully, but, you know, if you really want to test that theory, you have to come to our shows Friday and Saturday and at the Plaza.
Well, let's continue this conversation about hate watching, at least. I'm speaking with Trace Beaulieu. He played Crow T. Robot and the mad scientist Clayton Forster on Mystery Science Theater 3000. And as you heard, they'll be in front of a live audience. He'll be in front of a live audience with Frank Conniff on Friday and Saturday night at Atlanta's Plaza Theater. We've got details at gpbnews.org. But let's add a couple more voices to this conversation about hate watching. Kalina Baller is the host of the Credits podcast, and she joins us by Skype. Hi, Kalina.
Hi, good morning.
And also with us is comedian Larry Johnson, founder of Cineprov, which is a monthly event in Atlanta where comedians evaluate cheesy movies. Larry also worked as a writer for an episode of Netflix's reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's good to have you as well.
Thanks. Good morning.
What terrible movie was your episode about?
My episode was The Land That Time Forgot with,
that's
with
a terrible
Doug
movie.
McClure and Rubber Monsters and Cro-Magnons.
What makes, Larry, a really good bad movie?
I think if a movie tries really hard to be good and kind of fails, but fails earnestly, I think that's really important. I think if it's like trying to be silly, it doesn't really work as well, because it's just silly. But
right,
and you know, the only comments you can kind of throw at are like, well, that's just silly. But you know, if it's really trying, and I have a great respect for the filmmakers. I can't make a movie,
right?
You know, but I can see when they make a bad movie.
Well, let's hear a bit of a film that you like to hate watch, okay. And that is Showgirls. Here's a clip of that.
Do you like brown rice and vegetables?
Yeah.
You do?
Sort of.
Really?
It's worse than dog food.
I've had dog food.
You have?
Long time ago. I used to love Doggy Chow.
Oh, it's so bad.
It's so good. It's so brilliant.
So bad. Trace, what are the requisites for a good bad movie?
Well, I think Larry really hit the basis of it. A film really has to have been, had a lot of heart in trying to make a good movie and failing. But there's so much passion. Like, Ed Wood was, you know, got the label of being the worst filmmaker of all time. And through the years of Mystery Science, we proved that's not true. There are far less. But he had heart. And he put everything into his movie, including all his friends and some of his furniture. And still, we love Ed Wood. One of the films we'll be screening this weekend is Glenn or Glenda, and we love that movie so much. It's like a traveling companion now, but there is so much heart and earnest, intent on the filmmaker's part. And Larry mentioned about silly. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians is kind of falls into that realm of it's silly comedy, and even though that one still works, that one falls outside the formula. It to me, that was always like putting a hat on a hat.
Yeah, and there's another one that I can think of that sort of fits that. And Kalina, I wanted to ask you about this. And let's hear a little bit of the 1978 cult classic, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
The president's got him keeping an eye on the investigation.
Why him?
Because he's got a vegetable garden, that's why, with peas and carrots and squash and tomato.
That sheriff tells me there are reports of incidents like this all over the county.
One nut spots a flying saucer, and pretty soon everybody's shaking hands with little green men.
God, who would have thought? All we wanted was a bigger, healthier tomato.
So, Kalina, this is... This is a movie that a lot of people do hate watch, and yet it was a spoof. It was meant to be a spoof. Mm-hmm. Why does it work, then?
I think that when a movie is bad, or even a television show that's bad, that we love to hate watch, it becomes an interactive experience, and audiences love that. You know what I mean? So in a way, we really, really enjoy being able to say, give immediate feedback to something that we're watching. And I think a show like, Mystery Science Theater really took that and put just our reactions, or, what we would like to react sometimes, or how we would like to react sometimes, on display. I think it's brilliant. And, that spoof, it was a spoof. It was supposed to be bad. And it was supposed to, invoke that reaction from the audience. So,
and it does pretty successfully.
I think it did a job.
Yeah. You can see the tomatoes on like skateboards.
Yes. Horrible.
So a show you like to hate watch, Kalina, is IFC's Stan Against Evil. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Oh, I told you that baby was trying to kill me.
Well, now, Kevin, it's not a baby. It's a demon.
Whatever it is, it's back.
Okay, so Kalina, what makes this a good hate watch?
It's so bad. It's so bad.
But Larry's over here making faces.
I need to watch that. That's okay. Sounds amazing.
But here's I feel so treasonous even saying this, because this is also a Georgia filmed production as well. So Stan Against Evil follows the sheriff of this town that happened to be a town where hundreds of witches were killed years ago, and these witches and the sheriff have a weird spiritual connection, and crazy stuff starts happening to Stan and his family and the precinct all over the town. And it gets so absurd so quickly that it's almost brilliant. You know what I mean? It's the absurdity is so over the top, and that's what makes it so bad. So I'll watch it. Like you played that clip with with the demon baby.
Yeah, I feel like you don't need to go any further than Demon Baby. But.
Right. My friends who worked on the show sent me a couple of screenshots, and I was like, guys, are you serious? It's so great.
All right, Trace, I want to play this comment from an actual psychology professor. This is Mary McNaughton Castle. She teaches at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and she is here trying to explain some of the psychological underpinnings behind hate watching.
Part of why, for example, you're watching a show or a movie that's not very good and the people are dressed well or they're in good circumstances, but it's really done badly and you can kind of feel better. You can either feel better that you're not those reality people who have blown all their money, or you're not the producer who made that horrible B movie and thought it was going to be a hit. So it's a little bit of a way to compensate.
Trace, have you thought about that? Is part of our hate-watching attraction that we can feel better about ourselves?
I don't approach my hate-watching that way. I don't feel any better than the thing I'm watching. I don't feel that elitist quality. I kind of feel like I'm just as good as that. So I kind of feel better in that respect, if that's kind of a weird approach to it. But... I go, well, hey, I could do that. At least I could do that. I have those skills.
Yeah. All right. Well, then let me, Larry, I want to put to you another scenario here, because one of the shows I hate watched for a limited time was the ABC Family TV series Pretty Little Liars. Now, I hate this show because it... I'll tell you why I hate this show. Because it seems to care nothing at all about the fact that this teenage girl is dating a 30-something teacher.
Look, I think you're amazing, Aria. When I first met you, I thought, who is this girl?
I'm still that girl. Okay, nothing's changed.
Yes, yes, it has. I'm your teacher.
God. That's a different kind of hate watching, though, right? That's not funny.
Right. Yeah. That's creepy. That's pretty creepy.
So it sounds like to be truly successful entertaining Hate Watch, it sort of has to go so far and no further.
Yeah. I mean, I like Trey's, I don't really consider it hate watching. I don't hate any of the. I've hated a couple movies. And yelled at them. But for the most part, I sort of see what I do and you know, at Cineprov and what Mystery Science Theater does is we're like a companion in the movie, kind of. We used to do the show completely improvised originally, and I always sort of saw it as like the movie was my scene partner in a scene.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and it was like, all right, well, they said something and then I responded to it, you know, and vice versa. I would say something that I knew was coming up and,
right.
You know, so it sort of became this symbiotic relationship with the movie more than just yelling at a movie. You know, and nobody wants to sit and just, you know, hear a bunch of people, especially pay to hear a bunch of people just yell at a movie.
I apologize. What's interesting about that is when you try to translate that into watching television, we don't know often what's going to come, and we don't often, well, we do now because of Netflix and Hulu and whatnot, but we don't get to go back and actually watch these episodes over and over and over again. So often we're looking at them as they are released. And so it's brand new and people are reacting in real time. And, you know, they're just like, oh, why would you do that? Why is she doing that? Why is he doing this? And it's a really interesting. It's different, but it's similar, I think, in a way. Because you're making it like you're a scene partner.
Right.
You don't get that luxury with television, I don't think.
I want to play a clip of one of the movies Larry hates, which is the film Independence Day. Let's hear a clip of that. But, Kalina and Trace, I'm going to ask you if there's a relatively unpopular opinion you have. Like, maybe there's a movie that you think is terrible that other people might not agree with. But first, let's hear a little bit of Independence Day, which, again, Larry thinks is horrible.
Ship all banged up? Who's the man? Huh? Who's the man? Wait till I get another plane. I'm lining all your friends up right beside you. Welcome to Earth.
That's what I call a close encounter.
Yeah, he just punched the alien. Trace is there.
It's so good.
Trace, is there a movie that you think is bad that may not be that opinion may not be shared?
I kind of like the film Dreamcatcher, which is based on a Stephen King novel, and I might be the only one on the planet that likes it. I don't think the actors or director or anybody likes that one.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people saw it either. They were directed by Lawrence Kasdan, I think.
Yeah, it had a great pedigree.
Yeah.
But it's terrible, and I can't stop watching it.
Kalina?
For me, I am burdened with having the unpopular opinion that the most recent iteration of Ghostbusters was horrible. I couldn't stand it at all.
Oh, no, we're going to disagree on that, Kalina.
I know. We've had this conversation.
We
it's
have,
so bad.
And we'll probably continue to. But that's Kalina Baller, host of the Credits Podcast. Comedian Larry Johnson started the monthly event Cineprov, and actor, writer, and puppeteer Trace Beaulieu, who is best known for his work on Mystery Science Theater 3000. He'll be in Atlanta as well for some live shows. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you Friday, Trace.
That's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. What movies or TV shows do you hate watch? Do you believe in hate watching? You know how to reach us on Twitter or on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.